This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Ian McLagan, the British keyboard player whose band The Faces featured Rod Stewart on vocals, died Wednesday after suffering a stroke. He was 69. McLagan was among the first generation of British rockers, getting started in the mid-60s when bands like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were taking over the charts. McLagan played keyboards in the band Small Faces, which became Faces when Rod Stewart and Ron Wood joined the group. After Faces broke up, McLagan toured and recorded with the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, and others. He settled in Austin, Texas in the 1990s, where he formed his own group, The Bump Band, which released several albums and did regular tours. When he died, McLagan was preparing to go on tour with singer Nick Lowe. I spoke to McLagan in 2004 about his life in the rock world and his memoir called All the Rage. First, here's Faces' only hit in the U.S., Stay With Me. McLagan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to be talking to you.
You came of age at a time in the mid-60s that was really the dawn of British rock and roll and had been doing music all these years. Tell us how you got into music.
Well, that's an interesting... Actually, my mum paid for me to have piano lessons, but I didn't want to have piano lessons. It took me several years to figure out that that's what I was going to do with the rest of my life, but I wanted to play snooker with my pals, and who eventually formed a skiffle group, and which I joined as the T-chest bass player.
Now, I think you got to explain for an American audience what sniffle and snooker is.
Snooker is
snooker.
What pool? Yeah, snooker is what pool should be, with a much larger table and smaller, tighter pockets.
Okay. Snooker, right?
Yes. And they used to have a lot of snooker halls in England at that time, very popular. And I still like to play whenever I can. Skiffle was what preceded the Beatles in England. Lonnie Donegan was in a Dixieland jazz band in England, the Ken Collier band, and then the Chris Barber band. And in the intermission, he would play his version of blues. I call it kind of speed folk. It was very up-tempo and influenced by the blues and Leadbelly and all those guys, but it wasn't the blues. It was folk. It was skiffle. That's what it was called, and it became very popular, and almost everyone in my generation who ended up in a band started out playing washboard or guitar or banjo or T-chest bass. It was very kind of it was like punk in its way, you know, that it was very, you know, up and at it. It was all kind of and made up instruments. Didn't have to be talented. You just had to sort of bash away. And bit by bit, I kind of fumbled my way into playing. I got a guitar and I started playing a basic Chuck Berry riff, and then transferred that to the piano, which was sitting in the sitting room still. And which I hadn't played, but then when I heard Green Onions, Booker T and EMGs, I thought, well, boy, this is the sound for me. I've got to get one of those, whatever it is. And it turned out to be a Hammond organ.
When you were a teenager in the early 60s, and just scratching around in the music business. And it was a time when British rock was really just taking form. I mean, the Beatles and the Stones and the Who were all just getting going. And give us a sense of what the scene was like. I mean, were you aware that something kind of new and different, exciting was happening?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was in the air. You know, I loved the Stones. I used to see them every Sunday after I discovered them, you know, and then I'd follow them. I'd catch them on a Wednesday somewhere else, you know, and then I'd find they'd be playing somewhere else on a Saturday night, and I'd go there. And then when The Who came out, I met Pete very early on at Jim Marshall's drum shop, as it was, before he made guitar amps. I met Mitch Mitchell. He used to serve behind the counter there. He was later ended up as drummer with Jimi Hendrix, of course. And there was a buzz going on. And Townsend was like, first time I met him, he said, "So how are you doing? What's your band?" He was all interested in what I was doing. I was interested in what he was doing. And you know, we'd all heard the music, you know, and we wanted to play it. And then the next thing was to try and get gigs. And then, you know, I became manager and a kind of agent of my band, although I wasn't the singer. I was just the rhythm keyboard player. But it was very exciting. You just constantly trying to get gigs and playing and find out where the clubs were and checking other bands out and thinking, they ain't that good. We're better than them, you know. It was... I was too committed to know that, you know, I was just having the best time.
You were listening to a lot of American blues. Were a lot of British teenagers into that then? I mean, I don't think American kids were so much. Where did you get the records?
Well, they were difficult to find. You know, the thing is, one night Humphrey Lyttelton had a jazz program. I think it was a Monday night on radio. What was BBC One, I suppose it was then. And he played Muddy Waters live at Newport, Hoochie Coochie Man, and that pretty much changed my life. That album, which I eventually bought with great difficulty from the local record store in Hounslow where I lived, that and Thelonious Monk, Monk's Moods, just changed my life. I figured, well, Monk's a great blues player, and whoever is playing with Muddy is a great blues player. That was, of course, Otis Spann, and Otis is probably my main influence on the piano, you know.
So you're with the Mule Skinners. They split up and you find yourself bandless and then get recruited to an established group with a record contract, right? Small Faces.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, strangely, I was in another band in between, and but they weren't that keen to work, and the van broke down one night, and they kind of laughed, and we were supposed to be going up to Scotland, which is, you know, like 6 or 7 hour drive back then before the motorways, you know, and so we set up off again the next night and next afternoon, and the van broke down again. I said, "That's it, I quit," and so I was depressed, and I went to see my girlfriend that night. And on the way back, I bumped into a friend of mine, Phil, who said, "So how's the band?" I said, "Oh, I just left." And he said, "Oh, you should join the Small Faces." I said, "Oh, yeah, that's very funny, Phil." I thought, sarcastic. And the next morning, their manager called me, and that afternoon I joined the band.
Was that just a coincidence?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Because they had had that one hit, you see, and I'd seen them on television, and my dad said, "Check this band out, they're great." And I looked at them, I thought, boy, they're great. The great singer, and they look great. Well, that's the sort of band I'd like to be in, you know. And within, a few months, I was a member.
Ian McLagan recorded in 2004. He died Wednesday. We'll hear more of our conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to my 2004 interview with keyboard player Ian McLagan, who died Wednesday at the age of 69. Your big hit in America with Small Faces was Ichiku Park, and maybe we should hear that. Tell us about that song.
Well, strangely enough, Steve Marriott and Ronnie Lane wrote together, and it was hard to break into that partnership, although occasionally I would write with kind of a little germ of mine that Ronnie would help, and then that would come out as Marriott Lane McLagan. I could never just separate them. But in fact, I didn't realize that Ronnie Lane wrote that song. Almost, it's one of his. You know, the way a partnership works, it's one or the other mainly, and the other one helps. Well, that was a Ronnie Lane composition. And years later, when I was living in LA, he called me from Austin in 1990 and asked if I would tour Japan with him. And I said, I'd love to. I said, just one thing, Ronnie. He said, what's that? I said, let's not do Ichiku Park. He said, I said, I'm sick of that song. He said, but Mac, I wrote that. I said, I'm sorry, I hate it.
Do you really hate the song?
Yeah. Well, see, I don't think it is all too beautiful. I mean, I'm a lucky guy, I'm a happy guy, but I don't think it's all too beautiful.
Not so much like what the most of the music you were doing.
Right.
Well, with apologies to our guest, Ian McLagan, let's hear Ichiku Park from Small Faces.
Over bridge of sights, to rest my eyes in shades of green, under dreaming spots, to Ichiku Park, that's where I've been.
What did you do there?
I got high.
What did you feel there?
Well, I cried.
But why the tears there?
Tell you why, it's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful.
I feel inclined to blow my mind. Get up, feed the ducks with a bun. They all come out to groove about, be nice and have fun in the sun.
That was Ichiku Park by Small Faces. On keyboards was my guest, Ian McLagan. Ichiku Park is, it's a song that's sort of more in the psychedelic vein rather than the blues that you were playing. Is that what you don't like about it?
Well, it was, yes, but it's that, you know, we were, Ronnie, Steve and I took acid in 1966 and took acid again the next week and took a lot of acid over a period of time, and the music did change, and I think in some ways for the worse. I mean, it's like movies made around that time, some of them are so hopeless, I can't look at them now. They're just so desperately trying to prove that they've taken acid, you know. And it's all too beautiful was the chorus of Ichiku Park, and it's that whole thing, you know. I don't think you have to prove it. You know, the experience was pleasant, and now let's move on. Let's go back to what we were doing. But we never did, really.
It's also remarkable that you were in a band that had a lot of hits. I mean, you 14 hits in the UK, if I remember. And yet, you didn't make any money. You couldn't even afford your own apartments for a long time. Why?
We had management. We had very good management, or should we say thieves. We were just unlucky in that way. I mean, we were enjoying ourselves, you know, making the music and touring, but we never actually managed to get any royalties publishing or any money from the gigs. We were paid a wage of £20 a week, and that's pretty much, we had our we were living in a house together at that time. That was paid, and our food was paid, and our clothes were paid, and that was about it. That's all we got out of it.
You were awfully young. I mean, you were, what, 20, 21, and some of the guys were younger.
I was the oldest, yeah, and Kenny was 16. Yeah, I mean, we were ignorant about business. I mean, boy. And, I mean, we were so thrilled to be able to, you know, play music, really, and that it never occurred to us. We never had a bank account, and our parents kind of suspected it and went to have a meeting with our manager, Don Arden, and he threw a red herring in front of me. He said, people in show business spend money, and they spent theirs, and anyway, they're on drugs. And the parents then just left the office so downhearted, you know. And of course, we weren't on drugs. We were smoking pot.
Right.
You know.
The suggestion was,
or what they thought was, that we were on heroin or something, you know. That was the end of the inquiry into where the money was, you know.
Well, Ian McLagan, we were talking about your association with the group Small Faces, which split up when its lead singer, Steve Marriott, decided to leave and join Peter Frampton in a group, Humble Pie. And then you recombined and formed the group Faces. I mean, how did that happen?
Actually, we wouldn't have called ourselves Faces because we wanted to disassociate ourselves from Small Faces, because we figured, you know, with we had Ronnie Wood joining, Kenny, Ronnie, and I, and Rod Stewart, and we figured the music will be different. It just, you know, just naturally will be different, and we weren't going to use the name, but the American company, Warner Brothers, we signed in England, but the American branch, or the main part of the company, weren't willing to sign us unless we kept the name Small Faces. So, in fact, the album, our first album called First Step, came out as Small Faces in America and as Faces in England, because the English company said, no, we understand, but look, we can drop the small, we just have to keep Faces. And I think we thought we might be able to change the name after the first album. I think it was pretty stupid, but we would have been, you know, the strawberry newspaper egg or something, you know. I don't know. But Faces worked anyway, because it kept the lineage of Ronnie, Kenny, and me going, you know.
You had four albums and a lot of hits. You toured in the States. Let's listen to a track from the new CD box set. I thought we would listen to You're So Rude, which is a song you collaborated on with the late Ronnie Lane. You want to say a word about this, Tim?
Yes. I only wrote one song with Ronnie, actually, in all the years we were together. And he came over to my house, and I had a beautiful harmonium, a pump organ, in my in the hallway of the house, because I was having work done on the studio and I couldn't get it in there at that moment. So it was, you had to kind of squeeze past it. And he said, "Oh, that's nice." I said, "Yeah, listen to how it played." And I played him something I'd written on the harmonium. And he sat down and he wrote the lyrics to You're So Rude in about 10 minutes flat. And it's a true story how he and his girlfriend were caught at it, at her, his mum's house. Anyway, at his parents' house. And he suggests that he'll wet his socks, pretend he just got caught in the rain. Anyway, it's a true story.
Okay, so let's listen to You're So Rude. This is the group Faces. It was originally recorded on A Nod Is As Good As A Wink and is on the new 4-CD box set.
She likes you, she thinks you're swell. Got the makings of a dance hall girl. Your low-cut frock and your bird's nest hair. Stiletto heels and the way that you swear. She said to take you back to see my folks again. On Sunday. Looks as though there's nobody in. They've all gone out to see my Auntie Renee. Don't you worry, you just come right in. I'm sure we'll pass the time till they come home. Well, let me take your coat, kick off your shoes, warm your toes. Try the sofa.
That was You're So Rude from the group Faces. It's included on the new CD box set produced by our guest, Ian McLagan, who played keyboards. You know, one of the things that I like about that track, apart from the organ that you play at the top, is that it is not Rod Stewart on the vocal, who people have long associated with Faces, but Ronnie Lane, the late Ronnie Lane, the bass player. He gives a great delivery there, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. I mean, it's tongue in cheek. You know, you can hear his smile. You know, he was a very cheeky boy, Ronnie. And I met the girl in question, funny enough, previously. I'd met her when we were in Small Faces together. But he was the most prolific writer with the Faces and Small Faces. And I figured this box set, Five Guys Walk Into a Bar, ...
Right.
Should honour him as much as anything, because he's not around, he's not here to be honoured in person, and he's very much loved by all who knew him and know him or know his music. And so the box set is dedicated to Ronnie.
Keyboard player Ian McLagan recorded in 2004. He died Wednesday after suffering a stroke. We'll hear more of our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we're remembering rock keyboardist Ian McLagan, who died this week after suffering a stroke. McLagan's bands Small Faces and Faces were mainstays of the 60s British invasion. When Rod Stewart left Faces, McLagan recorded and toured with the Rolling Stones. He spent the last two decades in Austin, Texas, playing and recording with his group, The Bump Band. In 2009, the group released an album dedicated to McLagan's wife, Kim, who died in an auto accident in 2006. Here's the title track called Never Say Never.
I can feel your touch on my face. I remember kissing you for the first time. I can sense you just out of frame. And I'll be reminiscing for the rest of my life. Never loved anyone, I never loved anybody but you, baby. Never been lucky, baby, never back winners, but I know.
I spoke to McLagan in 2004 about his memoir, All the Rage, which includes a great story about how he and Kim got to know one another. One of the other colorful pieces of your life is that your wife, Kim, stole from The Who's Keith Moon.
Actually, I didn't really steal her, and she wouldn't accept that either. I mean, she had had enough of Keith, and she left, and I grabbed her.
Okay.
And I grab her still.
And Keith didn't take this easily. I mean, is it true that he once paid a guy, some thug, 200 pounds to break your fingers?
Yeah, unfortunately, I knew the guy, and I knew he was capable of it, but Pete Townsend got wind of it and paid the guy another £200 not to do it. So the guy did well. Keith never knew, and I carried on. I'm still playing. Yeah, Uncle Pete, God bless him.
Uncle Pete Townsend, who, right.
Yeah.
Did you ever kind of reconcile with Keith Moon before he died?
No. I mean, in person, he would be fine with me, but... you know, it made him very unhappy. He loved Kim. He just didn't know how to show her love or, you know, he was a very, I mean, really, if anyone was schizophrenic, I'd say Keith was. But I got on well with Keith every time I saw him. And I was a good friend to him before, you know, Kim left him. That's how I met Kim through him. But I met Kim just before they were married, you know, and I thought, what a beautiful girl. And every time I saw her, I thought, what a beautiful girl. What's she doing with him? And then I started hanging out when my first marriage fell apart. I used to hang out with Keith and Kim. And he eventually would fall asleep. And Kim and I would spend all day and all night just chatting and drinking and just becoming best friends, you know.
The name of the new CD box set is called Faces, Five Guys Walk Into a Bar. And in a way, you're five guys who walked into a bar and almost never left. I mean, drinking was a very big part of this band. Is it true that you actually set up a bar on stage behind the drums?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had drinks anyway. We figured, well, there was one of the guys was our tour manager, had nothing to do during the show. And so we dressed him up as a barman and had a bar built, which we carried with us. And in fact, Glenn Matlock is quoted, and I think it's funny, I don't know if it's true, but he said that during the drum solo in Losing You, we all went to the bar and stood there and chatted, ignoring Kenny thumping away there, and then walked back on stage as if to start, and Rod said, as if to say, well, you imagined, he said it, well, should we have one more? And we went back to the bar and left him there. I can imagine that happened, but I don't remember it.
Well, let's listen to a cut from Faces. This is one that I think, to me, captures a lot of the energy of some of those live performances, although it's a studio recording. It's too bad. It was originally done on A Nod Is As Good As a Wink. So let's hear Faces and Too Bad.
All we wanted to do it's a shame how I always get the blame. All we wanted to do was to socialize. Oh, you know it's a shame.
Well, Ian McLagan, when Faces split up, you'd stayed in touch with the Stones, with Mick Jagger, with Keith Richards, and they eventually invited you to collaborate on a recording session and go on tour. What was that like?
Well, actually, Keith and Woody invited me to go to Paris from London just for a weekend, which, you know, hotels were seen, beds were seen and made but weren't slept in, you know, and we just played nonstop for days, and then I got back to London eventually when the album came out, which was Some Girls, and I'd played on Miss You and Just My Imagination. When they started to tour, getting ready to tour in 78, Keith asked me if I would tour with them. I said, boy, yeah. And I jumped on a plane and toured with them and then stayed in America. Well, I went back to England, but then we moved straight after that. I liked America at that time. England was, there was nothing going on for me, you know.
You know, I read in your book that you played on those recording sessions for the Stones' Some Girls, and shocked to discover that they never paid you for that session.
Well, they did, but, you know, I mean, I was there as a guest. You know, I mean, I was, you know, I wasn't really, I hadn't been hired. I was there to socialize, really. But I said to Mick, is there any chance of any cash? And I think he gave me the equivalent. I was either 120 francs or 120 pounds. Didn't really pay for my cab fare, but...
Well, so you eventually end up touring with the Stones, which must have been a thrill. I mean, you admired them all these years.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you had a couple of awkward moments with Mick Jagger where he talked to you about payment, what you wanted to get paid, right?
Well, yeah, I mean,
Mick, guys were multimillionaires at this point, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, this was at the end of the tour. They wanted to record in L.A., and so I hung on there for a couple of weeks while we waited to get in the studio, and Mick had a conversation with me about money over a game of pool. And he's not really a drinker, Mick, you know, and I am a professional drinker. And so we had a beer together, and the reason he came over to the house was to discuss business, and I didn't know. I just thought he wanted a game of pool. Well, he got more and more drunk, and he said, so how much do you want? And I said, well, how long do you want to record? And he said, 2 weeks. I said, 15 grand. And he said, I'm not paying you 50. He thought I'd said 50 instead of 15. He said, I'll give you 20 and that's the end of it. And I said, okay. Well, of course, the next day he completely forgot about this conversation. And then, you know, we screwed around for several days with his employees as to, you know, deciding on what I'd be paid. And eventually I did get my 15, but not after a lot of argument.
You played with Bonnie Raitt and a whole lot of other artists. I mean, you became a fairly sought-after session musician, I guess. You declined a chance to play with the Grateful Dead. Why was that?
Well, I didn't actually decline the chance. Yes, it was a chance. I wasn't given the gig. A friend of mine who was a friend of Jerry Garcia's said they're looking for their current keyboard player has died, and they're looking for someone else. He said they want you to play to a tape and submit it, you know. And he said you'd make a quarter of a million a year, you know. You could live anywhere you want, blah blah blah. And I was actually on vacation at the time in San Diego with my wife and our dogs, and I went out and bought a Grateful Dead CD, and my wife went out to do some shopping and came back to the hotel room, and I was sitting in a blue funk in a brown study in a green swarm of hell. And she said, what's the matter? I said, I can't play this music. It sucks. I mean, just my personal taste. I didn't understand it, didn't get it. You know, still don't really. I mean, I know they make a lot of money. They got lots of fans. I'm sorry if I've upset anyone, but, you know.
Wasn't your cup of tea.
Wasn't my cup of tea, no more than Fish, all that jam band. That's so tediously boring. But, you know, I like a tune. I like a tune and a singer and a solo. And now more of the tune. Yeah, I just couldn't even do it, you know.
A lot of the guys that you shared, you know, a touring, recording, and performing life with, I mean, Ron went on to some pretty remarkable things. I mean, Ron Wood still plays with the Stones. Rod Stewart, you know, does his thing out there and plays at arenas. I mean, you do music, but at a sort of a more modest scale there in Austin. And I'm kind of wondering, do you like it better that way, or do you wish you were out there in front of these huge crowds doing it differently?
It's such a good question. You know, when I first joined the Small Faces, I was so happy because, as I said, I was playing every night, playing with people who wanted to play. And we'd play after gigs. We'd just play, you know, in a hotel room. We'd just, like, be playing and talking, listening to music. Well, I did an interview for a magazine called Beat Instrumental, which was about gigs and musicians, and, you know, in the current scene, back in 65. And they asked me, what did I see in the future, you know? And it's amazing what you say sometimes. And I actually said this. I said, I picture myself in a smoky club playing rhythm and blues. Well, hello, it came true, and I shouldn't complain because I love it still. I just wish I could make more money at it, but it's what I love to do.
You fell in love with the Hammond organ. In fact, there was one point when the Faces broke up that you went across continents trying to retrieve one you had. Are they still around? I mean, can you still find and play a Hammond?
Yeah, actually, they're to be found in a lot of churches. And sadly, when a church, for whatever reason, goes downhill, they sell their Hammonds or other organs, and they're often in perfect condition because they've never traveled. You know, I call her Betty, but I've had her since 1969. That's what you hear on Maggie May and on all the Faces stuff, and that's what you hear on all my records. She's been with me all that time, and she's really too. I mean, she's been around the world a few times. She's been beaten up, and you know, she's been damaged a little bit more than some Holiday Inn rooms. But you can still find them. I found a beautiful one in 1994 or 93. For $500, she's my pride and joy. She's in my studio at home and will never tour.
Well, do you play Betty because of the sentimental attachment, or does she have a sound that you just can't get anywhere else?
I've worked on her. I mean, over the years, she's a bit of a hybrid. She's a racehorse, you know, not just a plow horse. She's built for speed and built for sound, built for volume. She can. You know, electric guitarists like to think they're loud. You know, they can't top me. I can finally compete.
Well, Ian McLagan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Dave, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Ian McLagan recorded in 2004. He died Wednesday at the age of 69.